Welcome to another episode of Torkum Talk. Today we have the godfather of Bend, Jim Schell, on the show. This is exciting stuff, people. This guy is like the mentor of all the successful businesses in Bend, basically. He's 83 years young. He has more wisdom than anyone I've ever talked to based on his age. And we get into that. What is wisdom? What is knowledge? A bunch of really good philosophical things. And also breaking down like some of the things that he learned from building up businesses to 200 employees, what he would do differently. And just a huge learning opportunity for all of us. So happy learning with Jim Schell and I. Jim, you mentor a lot of people in town, being Bend, Central Oregon. You have been an architect to many things, as I said before in the intro. But mentorship being one of them, and one thing that you probably have noticed in all of your years of doing that is stress amongst people that you are being a mentor to, and perhaps yourself when it comes to the business.
Not much.
World. Not much yourself?
No, I did have when I had employees.
Okay.
As soon as I got rid of the employees, the stress went way down.
Interesting. Okay. So, what is like your advice to, what would your advice be to me for dealing with stress?
Well, let's see, who was it? I just met with somebody yesterday, one of the people that I mentor. Oh, I remember. And actually, this person was one of your interviewees.
Yeah.
And she brought up the same topic. And, you know, then that kind of question would follow. I'd have a half dozen questions mm-hmm. in return to try and figure out where stress is coming from and what the solution would be, might be. In her case and in your case, I mean, you have chosen an entrepreneurial career.
Yeah.
And there's a certain amount of stress that's going to go with that. Because by definition, entrepreneurship goes like this, right? And so, especially when you're down here, there's plenty of stress. If you had, there's other professions you could have chosen that there'd be a lot less stress in. You chose to be an entrepreneur, and there's going to be stress. So let's talk about.
So you're not saying that there is a way that there's not a magic pixie dust to make it all go away?
No.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
No, well, there, yes. Sell your business or and not have any more responsibility for other people. Mm-hmm. You have responsibility for employees. You have responsibility to solve their problems, customers, and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, if you could get rid of all that stuff, your stress would go way down. However, you're built to be an entrepreneur, and the stress comes with it. You can negatively impact it mm-hmm. by resolving some of the problems that are. So I had a business that grew to a couple hundred employees. A lot of my stress went away when we were somewhere around 100 employees and I could hire an HR person. Mm-hmm. So that person would handle all the stuff that most entrepreneurs don't like. Mm-hmm. So there you go. Grow your company so you can hire an HR director.
I have an HR director.
At how many employees do you have?
23.
Mm-hmm. That person probably does other stuff as well, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, but I oftentimes don't have a ton of stress. I end up meditating. I now practice yoga regularly, almost every day. But under my circumstance right now, I'm just getting back from vacation, and I guess all the problems didn't not wait for me when I came back. So just kind of dealing with that and just going through it like one at a time, and things are, I'm living. It's going.
Yeah. Well, a big part of the stress is because the buck stops here.
Yeah.
Some of the stuff that you do, you can delegate, but you can't delegate the buck. So you come back, you face the buck.
I feel like not everybody would know that term as generations are getting younger and younger, because that's Harry S. Truman's coined phrase. Do you want to describe it?
Well, it basically means the responsibility rests, the final responsibility rests in your chair. And I think Truman, that quote came about when he had to make the choice whether to drop the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. And that was when that, and talk about buck.
Right.
So.
That is right where it stops. So moving on to like Ben and the ecosystem here. You've been here for how many years?
26.
26. And through those years, let's see. How many booms and busts is that that you've watched over here?
Well, there was a dot-com 2000, and then obviously the 2008, and then the one we're waiting for.
What do you? Okay, the one we're waiting for. What is your take on it?
Well, I mean, obviously, I mean, if you look at history, right?
Yeah.
Just. And it's bound to, it'll be here, but I don't know where. There were some wide projections that 2019 was going to be the year. I'm sure we've all read that, and it didn't happen.
Right.
And so your guess is as good as mine.
What do you say to, like, businesses that try to prepare for that?
Well, it depends on how you define prepare.
Make sure they don't go under when the next one happens.
Well, if you're in an inventory business, get your inventory down. Get your receivables collected. All those kind of things, because once you go into a recession, receivables don't get collected. Inventory doesn't get purchased. So if you happen to be in a business that doesn't have inventory, which you are.
I am.
That's one good thing. You do have receivables.
I do.
Anything that and there's a good thing about. So I remember I had a business in the early 80s, and you wouldn't recall it, but interest rates got up to 20%.
On what? Everything?
Pardon me?
On what? Interest rates on
the Fed.
The Fed.
Yeah. So. I mean, I had a business that had both inventory and receivables, and if you have inventory and receivables, really, and a bank loan, that bank loan
just went to 20%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the bad news is that it almost took me under. The good news is that it didn't, and the further good news is it took a lot of the weak competitors out. So when it's all over. It's
what was the business, if you don't want me to ask?
Well, that one happened to be sportswear. So we this was in Minneapolis, which is where my business career was, and we would it was t-shirts, sweatshirts.
Business career is what are you doing now? I'd say you're very much in business.
No.
Okay.
I did start a business a couple years ago, but
you're helping businesses. All over Ben.
I'm helping businesses, yeah. So, but that's, I think I'm mentoring.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
mentoring businesses, though. You're not mentoring politicians.
But when I get done with you,
yeah,
I walk out the door and I go home and have a beer and I don't worry about anything.
Oh, that must be nice.
Yeah. It'll happen someday.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's being able to turn off that part of the mind is a hard thing for a lot of entrepreneurs. It's actually something that is like really difficult is being able to do what you were just talking about, having a beer and not worrying about it. That's actually something that crippled me for a bit here until I realized that I had to have some my own time, my own me time. Otherwise, I would just implode. And I watch way too many entrepreneurs do that. Because what would you say with the entrepreneurs you know, not just the ones you mentor, but all the ones that you know, how many hours do you think is the average work week?
Well, it depends on what phase of the business they're in. Okay. In the early startup stage, you know, I mean, I can't imagine starting a business and not spending 50 to 60 hours a week on it. As the business grows, you know, Scott Allen at Hydro Flask, my guess would be he's a, I know Scott. In fact, we're friends on Facebook, so you know, you know more than you need to know. And I would guess he's a 40-hour week guy now. And
yeah.
I know he goes on lots of trips and mm-hmm. vacations and all that kind of stuff. So his business is obviously mature,
mm-hmm.
and he doesn't have he's got a huge support system.
What if you looked at somebody that was in the startup phase that was doing 40 hours?
good luck. Yeah, good luck, because I don't think you can start a business in 40 hours a week. Now, when I was around, and by the way, when I started, there was no such word as entrepreneur.
Okay, then what was it?
Well, small business owner or mom and pop.
So it just became French.
I guess, yeah. I don't know where the word entrepreneur came from.
No, the French.
Yeah. Okay. What?
I don't. That's all I know about it as well. It recently became cool.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is cool to be an entrepreneur.
13th century French verb. Yeah, there you go. It's a 13th century French verb. Yeah. You
can meaning throw it up there. Meaning what?
To do something or to undertake.
To under, there you go.
Okay.
Yeah.
I bring that up because, believe it or not, this business was started with doing no more than 40 hours a week for the first few years. And then it started to get out of control and it got toxic when we started putting more into it. And when my wife at the time, still my partner, now ex-wife, were all we were doing about was talking about the business. And so it started where we were not putting more than 40 hours, and then it became where that was the only thing we talked about. Like dinner, we talked about it. In bed, we talked about it.
And was she in the business with you?
We found it together. She's still my partner. But she ended up, like, we ended up getting a divorce. And if you've been following me on LinkedIn, you hear all about it. I go into detail on just, like, my anger was one of the main issues, ego, arrogance, all sorts of stuff like that, and all good things for me to discover. But I look back at that as a lot of lessons, but one that is not kind of just coming to me right now as we're just having this free-flowing conversation of ours in a business. And the happiness curve and the success, I don't know if you can really correlate to ours. You kind of make graphs show whatever you want. At the end of the day, when we had, who was it, Brian in here with Skeptoid, the Skeptoid podcast in town, we had a fun time showing how there is a graph that shows autism linked to the organic movement, and autism goes up at the same rate that, organic foods are consumed goes up. And you could look at that graph and you can say, look at organic foods cause autism. But that is obviously ridiculous. It's just that the autism was being diagnosed at the same time that marketing movement began, that graph right there. So I don't know if what I'm saying, I don't know if what I'm saying actually does correlate to anything, that being said. But perhaps there is. Perhaps... not taking the business so seriously is why it flourished.
So let me say this. All people that start businesses are not entrepreneurs.
Okay.
And this is my definition. I believe that, for instance, if you go down to Wall Street, there's a lot of businesses there that are started to fund a lifestyle.
When you're talking about Wall Street, you're talking about...
I'm talking about Wall Street here in Bend.
In Bend, yeah.
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 And this very well may have been what happened in your business. I don't know this, but...
And Wall Street here in Bend, for those that don't know, that don't come here, is basically a shop with boutiques on it.
Gift shops,
boutiques.
Candy stores.
Yeah.
And all kinds of ice cream.
Tower Theater.
Yeah.
But besides that, a bunch of gift shops, candy ice cream, stuff like that.
Stuff that caters to tourists primarily.
It does, yes.
But in any event, so a lot of people start businesses in lieu of a job, right? And they are not committed to growing their business. An entrepreneur, on the other hand, for better or for worse, is committed to growing his or her business. And so if that entrepreneur who's committed to growing his or her business, chances are, I can't imagine it being less than 50 hours a week.
Yeah.
Now there's another thing about businesses, and that is there are good niches and there are bad niches.
What's a good niche?
Good niche these days is here in Bend in particular is tech, bioscience, outdoor. We've got some great businesses here in town, and they've been able to learn from each other.
Bad niche?
A bad business. I was in a bad business. I know bad businesses. I was in essence, what they call the rag business, which is clothing. And the clothing business is rough. Colors, sizes, all that stuff. Inventory is a killer.
Yeah.
Our customers were people like Walmart and Target and people that beat up the little guys on specs, on paying their bills, all all that kind of stuff. That's a bad business.
Have you researched much into what the business has become today, like fast fashion? So it's just what has turned in. It used to be the seasons of different Tommy Hilfiger and Gap, so on and so forth. Basically, they would launch, there would be three seasons a year of clothing. But now it's 52.
52 seasons?
Yeah.
Once a week?
Yeah, and so girls and guys are buying stuff at that rate as well, throwing out tons of clothing, and it's turning into a big, huge environmental problem. H&M, thanks. Yeah, H&M is one of the big pushers behind it, and Zohara or Zoe, so whatever. What's that?
Zahara.
And basically they just go, like, the whole shop is completely exchanged out, and people come in and buy the new stuff, and the fashion just happens that insanely fast, and it all gets put into landfills in Africa.
What a horrible business that would be.
Well, yeah, it got even worse than what you were dealing with, I suppose. Yeah. So when it comes around in the Bend business community, so watching the good and the bad, right now we're in a phase of real good, right? Like the city is growing, but there are some that would say that's bad. But keeping on the perception that it's good, why do you think are some of the main drivers as to where we are today?
You and I had this conversation yesterday. To me, I think we've got there's a couple of reasons, but the large reason is that we've got this infrastructure here in Bend that makes it, it's never easy. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know what the statistics are in Bend, but nationwide, supposedly, 4 out of 5 businesses aren't around to see their 5th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
So
I've heard that.
Yeah. And everybody's got a different slant on that, on that statistic, but needless to say.
A lot fail.
Yeah. So, and here in Bend, I would bet that it's less than that, but I have no idea. But we've got this incredible infrastructure here in Bend, or as it's better words for it would be entrepreneurial ecosystem. Roger Lee at Edco kind of got it started back. He came to Bend in 1999. And ever since that time, our ecosystem started to get better and better.
What was happening?
What was
Roger up to, you think?
I'm sorry?
What was Roger up to? What was happening since 1999?
Well, Roger is a hugely collaborative guy.
Mm-hmm.
Collaboration, by the way, is a hallmark of the way we do things in Bend, not just in business, but in other things too, but particularly in business. And Roger started that whole collaboration thing. Roger is the most humble, self-deprecating, good person with the greater good in mind, and all he cared, he would start organizations, and if somebody would come along and pluck it off and do it themselves, and that was perfect. That was fine with him. As a matter of fact, the less employees he had,
the less stress he had.
And Roger's truly an entrepreneur. He's got a couple of side businesses on his own. So, in any event, when he came to town, and some of the Brian Vieira's position, which is called, do you remember?
With Edco?
Yeah.
I don't remember.
Catalyst, Venture Catalyst. Mm-hmm. Which is basically he deals with tech companies, all the different pieces, BVC, Pub Talks, all this kind of cool stuff. These things incrementally came into Bend, and then there was Opportunity Knox. There was let's see, what else do we have? Pardon me?
No, there's a lot that named off.
OSU's brought some of the stuff that OSU's doing. Adam Kronecki over at the CoLab. There's just all this. And I mentioned to you that in 2014, myself and another guy went to Boulder to see what they had in their ecosystem. They're known as one of the more business-friendly communities in the U.S., particularly on this side of the Mississippi. And our purpose of going was to find out what they had in their ecosystem that we could bring back and put in ours. And after spending 2 days and meeting with a dozen different movers and shakers in Boulder, we found out that our ecosystem was broader than theirs. We had more good, cool stuff than they did. They didn't have a BVC. They didn't have a Pub Talks. They didn't have Opportunity Knox. There's some other stuff. So that's the good news. The bad news is that while we were broader, they were deeper. Their VC fund at the time was $250 million. One of their VC companies in Boulder was $250 million. At the time, ours was $10 million. Mm-hmm. Now it's $40 million. So,
getting a little deeper.
Yeah. But. So anyway, from that, I learned that I think that our ecosystem here in Bend, and I know a little bit about the rest of the Pacific Northwest, is at the top. Our BVC is the largest venture conference in the Pacific Northwest. Judging from Boulder, we didn't go to Austin, although we probably should have. They're a very entrepreneurial friendly community as well.
Absolutely.
But we have more services for a small business owner. We've got all these organizations. We've got people who like me, not as old as me perhaps, but people like me who want to give back. Preston helps more businesses in town than as many as Roger and Brian Vieira, and just does it because he wants to, because it feels good.
That's what you do as well. So that being said, let's walk, because people could be here now, like, okay, that's great, but where do I start? How do I start? So I was just thinking of a scenario. Let's say, Jim, that we're going to start a tech company here in Bend. So let's say it's going to be an app. The app's going to deliver food.
Yeah.
Cool. Cool. Mm-hmm. Food delivering app. What is, we kind of go back and forth on what should an entrepreneur hear if they're going to start here in Bend? Who should they go to? How should they get?
First place you'd go would be Brian Vieira at Edco. And then you'd ask him that question. What should I do?
What should I do?
Okay. Yeah. And he, you know, there's Founders Pad. You've heard of Founders Pad. Mm-hmm. There's Opportunity Knox. Preston has an OK team.
I don't think we really talked about that much on the show. Mitch, could you put that up on there, Opportunity Knox? But like going in depth on that, because we brought up, oh yeah, I'm part of Opportunity Knox, but I don't think we've gone into that. So, okay, this new guy of his food delivery app, Opportunity, okay, what is that?
Did we morph to Opportunity Knox, or are we back
We're looking at like what good is my food delivery app going to get from what value is my food delivery app going to get an opportunity in Knox?
Okay, well, so basic Opportunity Knox is an organization, a peer problem solving organization. Mm-hmm. So I use the pronoun we. I still am. I facilitate a team just as Preston does. As a matter of fact, Preston is in my team.
Yeah, and Preston facilitates my team.
Ah, oh, you're in that team?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a smoking hot team.
Yeah, we have a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It has a reputation.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's a good one.
Well, hopefully it's good. but basically an OK team is 10 to 12 people in the same room, in the same team. They meet once a month for 3 hours with two volunteer facilitators, and where they create an environment for the entrepreneurs to succeed. Mm-hmm. Basically what it is you have your own board of advisors. So you got 12 people or 10 people or whatever helping you, and in theory—
And you help them too.
And it doesn't work if it doesn't go both ways.
Sure.
But small business problems are finite. Mm-hmm. And so if you have a problem collecting your receivables or managing employees or whatever it is, chances are someone else out of those 10 or 12 people will have had the problem before.
If not at that same moment, or have had it before, or they don't know that they're about to be hit by it.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I heard my OK team. I better watch out for that time when I get to that point.
Yeah. I have heard, I've been in Opportunity Knox now for 4 years, I think. And I have heard so many horror stories that I've been able to divert because of what some of them have gone through. And they've heard horror stories that I've gone through that they've been able to divert. And actually, as a matter of fact, this guy is this side hustle of mine, Habit Hot Sauce. This guy, this is a product of...
I'm aware of it.
Yeah, it's a product of Opportunity Knox.
No kidding.
Oh, yeah, because so basically my group is... I have a food manufacturer, Red Plate Foods. I've had Garrett with July 9 in there. That's also manufacturing things. I've had tons of different manufacturers in and out of the group. And I've learned so much from their headaches. I've heard all sorts of stuff. So when I started in there, I'm just like, okay, I'm talking about building a technology-driven marketing company. I'm not manufacturing anything. I'm dealing with clients that are manufacturers, so this is good to hear those. But I wasn't really sure where the value in those problems with inventory and things like that were going to end up coming. But I was absorbing it. I was listening. I was like, huh, maybe if you ever thought about this. Or a lot of times I'll just stay in silent because I didn't have a lot to give at that moment. But I was learning. And all that stuff did get stored with me. And then also when I was just like, we should do something like this, not only do I have some form of education to what to do, but I also have the people to go to and to talk to that are more than willing because of that group. Yeah. So, okay, so we have the food.
I just want to add one point to that. So an OK team, I said it was an advisory board.
Right.
It's also a focus group. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you used it as a focus group.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And then it's also a, I'll tell you a story about OK. This is years ago. I was visiting I was the founder of OK. I think you knew that.
I did know that, and we said it in the before the notes, but that's pretty cool. So thank you, Jim.
Yeah,
cheers
okay.
to that. Because
oh, shucks.
That, yeah, it's without nothing. That, I don't think Habit would be anywhere.
In any event, so I don't know how many teams we had back then, but I would go and visit each team during the course of a year. So I go to a team, and bear in mind, everything's confidential, as you know. And so I go to this team, and I'm going to give them half an hour spiel on what's going on in OK, and then leave because they talk confidentially, and I don't want to be there. Mm-hmm. And so I do my deal, and then one of the members said, oh, I know. I was looking for the term support group. So focus group, advisory board, support group. So one of the members said, Jim, when you're done, would you mind staying? I have a problem, and I think you could give me some input on it. Mm-hmm. Sure. So I stay. The guy says, here's my problem. My bookkeeper quit yesterday, and she's also my wife.
Okay.
So you can see where the support group came in, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, one day he's married, and the next day he's on a path not to be married, right? Yeah. And so his group, and we had one team, OK5, that had probably averaged, and they had 10 or 12 members, probably averaged, each member within their 10 or 12, the average might have been 12 years. One of them, they just disbanded a couple of years when the facilitator, who was my wife, sold her business and decided to reduce her stress in lots of different ways. Not me. I'm still here.
You're
I'm
still in the
there
picture.
To stress
That's
her
good.
Out. Yeah. But in any event, that team, that those members stayed in there together for 10 or 12 years. Mm-hmm. Who knows more about, and here's another deal about entrepreneurs, by the way, it's the loneliest profession in the world.
It is.
Right. I mean, you've got a problem. Where do you go?
Yeah.
And so you go to your OK team, and that's the... And a lot of the you can't take your problems to your spouse, and vice versa.
No.
And so as you learned probably the hard way.
I did learn the hard way. Yeah. No, that's true. If you think you can, then after a while that will be create its own burden onto your relationship.
Yep.
And so you really don't have anywhere to take it to. You can't talk to your team members about it. You could talk to your friends about it, but after a while, they're going to...
That doesn't work.
Yeah, they can't really relate if they're not with... Unless they are entrepreneurs.
Unless they're
themselves.
An entrepreneur themselves. Yeah. And if they've had a cash flow problem, or if they've got too much inventory, mm-hmm. or they've had the one customer who's 40% of their business and he goes away.
Yeah.
All those kind of things.
Yeah, I've had several times over the 4 years of being in OK where people have broken down and started crying. And yeah. We've been able to pick them up and help them because that's the lonely thing. There's this whole cool thing about being an entrepreneur, like, oh, look how cool that is. You're the boss and this and that. I'm like, well, yeah. It comes with a price.
I do.
It comes with the price of like it all. The buck stops at you with all this stuff. And when you clock out, when you're done being employed somewhere, you get to have your beer and relax. Unless you're in a really toxic work environment where they work you to the bone, which in that case, quit your job. But, you know, you get to relax where the entrepreneur, it stays with you. Even on vacation, it stays with you. I just got back from El Salvador and it was just like surfing a wave and an idea came to me. It was actually good. It was a great idea. I just implemented it. Mm-hmm. But it's still, I was thinking about it. Should have just been surfing.
You're not a, you're not a member of the Shiny Object Club, are you?
Shiny Object Club? Well, you saw that habit thing behind you. So, yeah.
Well, you said you had an idea when you came back, and this you've been back for a day?
2 days.
2 days, and you implemented your idea.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like a groundbreaking idea. It was just, hey, we can help our client getting additional revenue by doing X.
Yeah.
And I was just like, okay, I'm going to put an X.
Well, and my point is that most entrepreneurs are shiny object people.
Yeah.
And it would be interesting. You had Scott Allen, I think. It would be interesting to ask him about how important is it to have a naysayer in your business? And because we are also entrepreneurs are eternal optimists. Mm-hmm. I can take this idea and I can make something out of it.
Yeah, you're very right. Naysayers are incredibly important. If I didn't have one, so my partner, Sarah, ex-wife, great person, she's my naysayer. And if it wasn't for her, the company would be under.
Yeah.
And like, because there's been so many things, I'm like, we're gonna run this, and she's just like, stop.
Yeah.
And yeah. Some things I'm like, no, you gotta yeah. trust me in this, and then she'll like really, and then we're able sometimes to do it. But there's been things that she's stopped me on that I've watched other people try to do and it completely falling apart. There's been times I look back at that idea and laugh.
Yeah.
At the thought of that. So.
Well, your CFO or your finance person is supposedly the good ones can bring up the adverse reasons not to do whatever it is you're thinking of. Your attorney. I had an attorney. My attorney in Minneapolis was also my tennis partner.
Okay.
So he wasn't shy about telling me I was out of my head.
Uh-huh.
And I would go to, I don't know about you, you read a book, right? You read Good to Great, and you come out of there with three or four different ideas.
Yeah.
And whammo, all of a sudden, you know, all the things that you've had for, you've had in your company goes, we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them work, some of them don't. But yeah, we're shiny object people.
Yeah, I guess that's the yin to the yang. It's good to end up having that naysayer. Otherwise, you know.
Look at Elon Musk.
Yeah.
Talk about shiny objects.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how he manages them all.
I don't either.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Well, apparently he doesn't sleep, so that helps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's part of it.
Okay, so going back to we're building the food delivery app. And so we went and we talked to Brian, and then we joined Opportunity Knox to have our board of advisors. What other advice do you think you'd have in the Bend community here to continue to grow and be prosperous?
Well, again, if it's tech, you'd look at Founders Pad.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the number one, find a mentor.
Ah, let's dive into that.
Oh, we just morphed into my favorite subject.
Yeah, let's dive into that. okay, let's start with how. How do you get a mentor?
That's a good question. The chamber is talking about implementing some sort of a mentor program.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, there's no official way to do it in Bend. We have an ecosystem that will support interns, right?
Mm-hmm.
But not mentors. It's basically matching mm-hmm. mentors and mentees. It's not rocket science.
No.
But nobody's done it. And I know the chamber recognizes that it's something that, particularly in Bend, we've got all this talent.
Yeah.
And not all of them old. I mean, you don't have to be old to be a mentor, right?
No.
A 15-year-old can mentor a 10-year-old.
It's very true.
Yeah.
So it's not surprising that Katie's working on something like that. But let's say that that project of making the matchmaker, Tinder for mentors is a few years out. And our entrepreneur needs something
right now.
Sooner than that, yeah.
Well, let's see. If I were that mentor, and tell me again. Oh, he's got an app.
Yeah.
Then you know what I would do? I would go to Preston.
Yeah, I would go to Preston too.
Because Preston understands our tech community, right? And somewhere mm-hmm. in that tech community, I don't know how many app companies we've got, but mm-hmm. dozens, if not, probably more than 50. Mm-hmm. And somewhere in those 50 companies are someone who's done an app that's relatively similar.
But you can't, if we were to go, if okay, so let's give our persona of this entrepreneur a name. Let's call her Molly. So Molly wants Preston as a mentor.
I didn't say that Preston would be the mentor.
Right.
He would hook her up with the right mentor.
Okay.
So if Molly has this special app, he knows most of the tech companies in town.
He does.
And he would say, you need to talk to Charlie. He's got an app in a space that's similar to yours.
Okay.
So I'm just using him as he's a mentor broker.
Yeah, I guess he would be the best mentor broker. Okay, so Molly goes to Preston. Preston hooks him up with a mentor. How should... I think this is like the thing, like, okay, so how do you then, like, if Preston then gives Molly an email to that let's see, the collective, or Dan Holman of G5.
Yeah,
whatever. And now Molly needs to reach out. What do you think is the best tactful way of doing that?
Yeah.
Well, because if you just come up and you just say, my point is like, if Molly's just like, hey, Dan, will you be my mentor? Yeah. Dan's going to be like, do you know how much shit I have to go on right now? I don't have time to be your mentor.
Yeah. Well, there are, and I don't know which Dan is, but there are people who want to mentor and there are people who don't.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody, I've had this happen, and I've had a mentor situation that didn't work. I got fired.
You got fired?
I got fired.
As being a mentor?
Uh-huh.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
What'd you do?
So I went my own merry way. So yeah. There's a certain amount of accountability that has to be involved in a mentor-mentee relationship. Mm-hmm. And in this case, this person was he worked remotely for a San Francisco tech company, and he had like 5% ownership in the company.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it was maybe the second or third meeting, and I said, so this ownership that you have in this company, what are the sales of the company? Are they profitable? I asked him 3 or 4 questions. He said, I don't know. I said, so wait a minute, you're part owner of this company, and you don't know what the revenues are, and you don't know whether it's profitable. And he says, yeah, well, you know, I didn't want to ask.
Mm-hmm.
I just took the job. And I said, okay, I'm telling you that I don't think that's healthy. So I said, I would suggest that you find out. And at our next meeting, tell me, and we can talk a little bit about the business. And he says, okay. And then the 2 days later, I got an email from him. You know, I don't think this is working.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want to be accountable. And you know, I don't know the undercurrents of that situation. Maybe maybe his boss, the owner, was a total jerk.
Mm-hmm.
And
maybe he's too afraid to ask.
Well, in my opinion, that's wrong.
Yeah.
But he didn't want to deal with it, and so...
A lot of people don't like dealing with conflict. That doesn't mean they shouldn't, just they don't like to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, there shouldn't be any conflict in that. He's a part owner of the company, right?
I mean, he still ends up raising his anxieties and everything like that. They're not... Not everyone is... I have to deal with that kind of stuff on a daily basis, and it still drives butterflies for me sometimes. Not every time, but there's certain scenarios, certain conversations I need to have, whether with clients or team members. I'm like, here we go.
Yeah.
And I don't like to do that stuff. I'm like, oh boy, today's difficult conversation day. It's a day I dread.
So I have to tell you this story because this is my favorite, probably my favorite, and I've been mentoring now for maybe 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And today I probably mentor, I don't know, 30 to 35 people. This is my favorite story. So I've got a young woman, and she's saucy, and I like saucy. Mm-hmm. Saucy's good. And so we have a meeting scheduled for the next day, and she has an assignment.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't often give assignments per se, but we do follow stuff up. But she had an assignment. So I get an email the day before the meeting. It says, Jim, I haven't done my homework. So, but instead, I would like from you the answer to the following questions. So she pushed back the relationship back on me and all of us. And the reason I point this out is she asked, I'm a big fan of question asking. Mm-hmm. You can't be a good mentor if you can't ask good questions.
I agree.
And you're good at asking questions. I've picked that up.
I appreciate that.
In any event, so she says, and so she gave me these 4 questions, one of which was the best question I've ever been asked.
Mm-hmm.
And that question was, what was the number one lesson that you learned from each decade in your life?
Wow.
Wow. Now, especially when you got 8 decades.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, can you give us a highlight or two?
Yeah, let's see. Decade number one was, I don't know if I can remember all of these, but in fact, I know I can't. But decade number one was, I like sports.
Okay.
Decade number two was, I like girls.
This is great. So far true for me, too.
I can't remember decade number three, but decade number four was, I had to work for myself. Mm. It took me the whole third decade to figure it out that I was going to be a lousy employee.
Got it.
Then I learned a lesson in the fifth decade that I didn't want to spend the rest of my life with the partner that I had been with for 26 years.
That's an interesting lesson.
I can't remember the other decades, but...
Well, sure you can. Those are the latest ones.
Well, I'm in the throes of the latest, but I tell you, my best decade of my life was my 60s.
Okay. Why?
Because I changed more lives in the 60s than I did in any other decade, which is what I try and do.
Is that something that you end up learning later in life to serve others and is something in the earlier decades?
Yeah, it's just
decades?
Something I just drifted into.
Yeah. Do you think yourself in the third or fourth decade would think that your fifth decade, the 60s, would...
No.
Would have saw that?
No, because I was an archetypical entrepreneur, and back in those days, we didn't have nearly the ecosystem that you guys have. We didn't have it. I mean, opportunity knocks, mentors, interns, all these things that you turned me yesterday, you used interns, right?
Yeah.
All these things, we didn't have any of that. We didn't even, there was no Inc. magazine, no Entrepreneur magazine. There was no Barnes & Noble.
You didn't have an internet to ask questions either.
Huh?
You didn't have an internet to ask questions either.
No.
Because you could type anything into Google.
Yeah.
How do I start a food app company? You could type that into Google and at least get you going.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, our only learning mechanism was trial and error, which is you've got choices.
So the trial and error mechanism... it's not a bad learning curve, though. I mean, it's something that
the good
teaches
news
really
is
quick.
You don't forget the lessons.
Right?
The bad news is they're so effing expensive.
Right. They're expensive, but they are lessons that are completely ingrained in you. And it's something that you're able to teach other younger or whatever age entrepreneurs in town.
Yeah. But you know what? I wouldn't have burned out. So I burned out at my company at 200 employees.
Uh-huh.
And had I access to, I couldn't make the transition from being an entrepreneur to a manager.
Mm-hmm.
And if I knew then what I knew now, I could have saved me.
Saved you?
Yeah, saved me. I would have had a 500 employee company or 1,000 employee.
Would it have made you a better life?
At the time, I'm totally growth. I'm a growth guy.
Yeah,
it's all about growth.
But where you are now,
we
might not even be talking right now if you made a 1,000 employee company. Do you know how much stress comes with that?
No, I don't know because I've never been there.
Yeah, either do I. But I can imagine that's like, let's see, I have 20 right now, so that's times 50. Yeah, that would be that'd be 1,000. I'd probably be dead.
It depends on the team that you have.
Well, don't you find it interesting that the things that the media doesn't talk about when these CEOs die of big companies, like Oracle, he died pretty young. I think he was 61 or 62. He was the latest I remember. Steve Jobs. I mean, the list kind of continues to go and go. These guys aren't going into their 80s like you are, Jim.
I know, but it was Steve Jobs he's on a different planet.
Well, the Japanese also have a word for it. I think it starts with a K. Mitch, can you look up Japanese, the word for working themselves to death? Because it's a big problem where, like, Japanese men... What's it?
Karoshi,
thank you. Yeah, karoshi. They literally will work to death. And not at an old age. It'll be at a younger age by having all those stresses and everything.
Over my career, I've known a lot of entrepreneurs who lived a normal life, who retired young, who lived to be old. We don't all have to die young.
Yeah.
No, they put together great teams,
mm-hmm.
right? Maybe they were in a niche that was easier than yours.
Perhaps. I mean, going through like, oh my gosh, everything's. I'm just basically start off with a little stress conversation because I got back from vacation and have a few of these problems. But for the most part, the team does a really good job over here, and yeah. it's a pretty.
But the point is that you can get to 1,000 employees without being a basket case.
I agree, but I also think that you shouldn't regret not getting there.
That what?
You shouldn't regret not getting there.
Well, at today I don't.
Good.
But then I took it personally. Do entrepreneurs like to fail?
Of course they don't. But I mean, everything happens for a reason. With the failures you've learned has allowed you to set the precedent for the great things that you've done here?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that I like to fail. And that doesn't mean that being successful isn't a better
option than failing.
Yeah.
Yeah. The failures, though, is that what allows us to feel success anyway? Like, what happens when you don't have failure at all? Then what does success become?
Everybody's gonna fail.
Yeah.
Especially entrepreneurs who have this shiny object problem.
Sure.
So yeah, I'm just saying that I learned as many lessons from successes as I did from failure. That's all.
Okay. So when it comes to those like lessons that you're teaching other people, like what are some of the ones that you're seeing like of the people that are getting into the 50s, 100 employees that you don't want them to make the mistake that you saw yourself making?
Building the right team.
Okay. In what way?
In what way?
So if you're talking about building the right team, I'm sure you're talking about a management. Well, I'm not sure.
Yeah, right.
I'm assuming
no,
a management team.
Yeah.
Okay. What makes a good management team?
Well, one that requires less and less attention. If you've got a COO and you don't have to talk to him for a week, nice job.
Okay.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
If you've got a sales manager that you're meeting with two or three times a day, not so good. You got the wrong guy. So, you know, from my standpoint, I think that and most entrepreneurs aren't great delegators because they think that they can do the job better themselves.
Yeah, that's that merchant mindset. That's where they don't end up growing into a leader, in my opinion. Like, really, because how can you? How can you have anybody else do anything if you insist that you can do it better?
Yeah.
You must. I mean, did you find yourself running into those problems with 200 employees?
Sure.
Okay. That's surprising because it's a lot of people. 200 employees, that's a big company. You built something pretty awesome. I'm curious, what were some of the things that you would, like, do you remember any specific examples of like, oh, I could do this better than so-and-so, so I'm just going to do it? When it should have been pushed.
Yeah. So, well, this is a failure. Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you about one of my outstanding failures.
Good. Thank you.
And so this was before I was even an entrepreneur. This is when I was working for somebody. Minneapolis, winter, hockey, outdoor hockey. And I had three boys, and so they all played hockey. And if you can extend the life of an outdoor ice, then the kids can add a month onto the front end, mm-hmm. a month onto the back end. Instead of being a three-month season, outdoor ice could be a five-month season.
Okay.
So, hey, I got an idea. All you need to do is put a roof over ice, right? So mm-hmm. the park department. in essence, today, that's kind of what we have here in Bend, right?
Yeah.
It's just a roof over a piece of ice.
Huh.
In Minneapolis, so it's outdoor ice. It's natural ice. You got to keep the sun off it. That's mm-hmm. what the roof's for. So, yeah, hey, let's build. And I was working for a timber company at the time. And one of the things that they sold was fence posts.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, hey, my company needs to come up with a way to build a roof truss. So you have to span 80, so hockey rink's 85 by 200. So you got to span at least 90 foot. You got to have and that will withstand 4 feet of wet snow. And so I said, wait, what if we build all the different members out of wood? In essence, a wood truss
mm-hmm.
with fence posts.
Okay.
Talk about shiny object. But somehow, I sold it. I sold a park and making it sound simpler. We had to do a lot of engineering and stuff, but I sold it. The good news is that it worked. The bad news is that the company I worked for probably lost, they never told me, but probably $250,000.
Jeez.
This was back in, this would have been, when was it, the late 60s. So $250,000 then is whatever today. A lot of money.
Yeah.
So I learned that lesson on somebody else's nickel.
That's good.
Thank you. So what led me to that story anyway?
Big failure that,
That. Yeah. And one of the main reasons, the problem was not the elements of the construction, not the fence posts or the connections. The problem was the installation.
Mm.
This is basically a geodesic dome out of fence posts.
Mm-hmm.
And so the thing wouldn't go together, and it cost us an arm and a leg to finally get it together. So the good news is it worked. The bad news is...
You end up learning the failure, and then you are able to move on and see it coming again, because history can repeat itself unless you do something about it.
Yeah. Oh, so I know the point of all this is that I learned one of my big shortcomings is attention to detail.
Got it.
And, I mean, talk about detail and trying to put together this and hiring a construction company. So I was basically the construction foreman. And you don't want to build an ice arena roof if you have a detail problem.
No, you definitely don't. That's funny. That's one of my weaknesses as well. That's why you have to implement people to be putting in the right things and making sure the detail is taken. I'm just like, this is a concept that I think we need to do, and it's going to be great. The details of it, that sometimes gets blown back, which is a good thing. That's where the yin and yang can come back from. So that was in what year?
1968, 1969.
Okay. So now we're going, let's see, it's 42. Yeah, no, it's let's see. Math is bad. 52 years later. So you were what? You're 83 now.
I was, at the time I was 32.
I was 32.
And I still hadn't figured out what I wanted to do when I grew up. So I didn't start an entrepreneurial career until I was 34.
So, what's it like today? So you've gone through, you were talking about all these decades, that the things that you've been learning, and even late into your life, you're creating opportunity knocks, and you're still a mentor advising multi-million dollar companies here locally. What's it like to get old? What's it like to be doing that in a business community? What's it like? I don't know much about it, but I think
hugely
a lot of people fear
rewarding.
It. Okay.
Hugely rewarding.
How so?
If I help a company, and that company goes on to hire 50 people, 70. Opportunity Knocks is a perfect example. If Opportunity Knocks, I think they've got somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 businesses in there. What if, because of Opportunity Knocks, each business adds 5 employees. 5 times 200 is 1,000 lives. Sure. So there's so much leverage in helping people build businesses.
So barring that, do you find it frustrating at all as well in to get old?
Frustrating to get old. Well, yeah.
I mean, things don't work the way. I mean, I'm only 32 and I just got diagnosed with gout. So I'm completely changing how I eat. I don't drink anymore, all sorts of stuff to make sure I don't get
good
it
news
anymore.
On that one.
Yes, it's great news. I'm getting a lot more sleep, but enough about that, my issue. But that wasn't happening in my 20s, so I could only imagine what's going to happen in my 40s and 50s.
Yeah, well, I mean, it obviously, I was always active in sports all the way up, and so I've taken decent care of myself. And now it's paid off up until now. I've got some structural issues, like rotator cuff and back and all the old guys kind of stuff. But, you know, you can stretch those years out. The average age now of the American male is 79. Mm-hmm. So I'm on borrowed time.
But so, do you ever find like, people not to, this isn't something, or it's just an idea. Do you ever find people that don't take you seriously because you're older in the business community? And they're like, oh, what does Jim know?
No.
Okay.
You know, I suppose if I were new to town and you know, we have a lot of talent that comes to this town that come from somewhere else, and they were Lou Capozzi. Have you met Lou Capozzi yet? Have you heard Lou? He was the CEO of the fourth largest PR company in the world. He lived in New York, and now he's works with Ben 2030 and what. We just get a lot of talent to this town. But even if I were to hook Lou up with somebody in the PR business, they'd probably look him up and down for a while till they figured out whether he was any good or not, right? Mm-hmm. In my case, I've been here for 26 years, and people know me, and so no, I don't have that problem. If you know, I'm living in Tucson now a fair amount of time, and if I started to do this kind of stuff in Tucson, it would take me a while to build up the reputation. But as a matter of fact, you know. So I'm right. I mean, just my next book, which is called Where Wisdom Comes From. And one of the things I learned from writing it is that wisdom is one of the few things that gets better with age. I mean, what else can you think about, right?
So is that the main thing that you're writing about, is that wisdom is coming from age in your book?
Yes. Yeah.
What do you define as wisdom?
What do I define as wisdom? Let's see. There's a. I think wisdom is a compilation of all of our experiences.
Okay. It's for negative or so. Can there be bad wisdom and good wisdom?
Well, there's good lessons learned from bad experiences. Yes. Is there bad wisdom? I don't know that there is.
Okay.
I don't know. Don't think so. But
so a man that is. Older is wise.
Yeah, but you're wise.
Not as wise as you.
Yeah. How old are your kids?
I don't have any.
Okay, well, if you had a 10-year-old, that 10-year-old would be wiser than a 5-year-old.
Yeah.
But in my, you know, in my case, that's being a little flippant, I guess, but in my case, the wisdom, you know, almost anything that comes up, I've got a story for. Oh, well, just you asked, right? You asked a question, and I can come up with a story.
Sure.
And therein is where wisdom comes from. Is wisdom comes from experiences. As someone once said, smart is knowing how a gun works. Wise is knowing when to use it.
Okay, interesting. So, there is no. In your in this definition, we do not have an existence of an unwise older person.
I don't think so. I mean, Wise doesn't. I'm sure there's a Wise terrorists, right?
Yeah.
And so Wise doesn't measure.
So I guess that just goes by a perception of good and bad. So you can have
people. Yeah, but has, they're wisdom. Still wise.
What about poorly educated wisdom? What about if you have a person who never went to any form of education and was just, let's say, living in...
North Korea.
Sure, North Korea, I guess.
That person's wise.
Okay.
Right?
I'm not saying they're not. Yeah. I just like to go into the actual... I think you're answering this very simply, and I love it.
There was a story somewhere I read about a woman.
Mm-hmm.
She'd outlived her husband, and I don't know if they had any kids or not, but she was in Siberia somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Lived by herself in Siberia. The winters, right? I mean, she's got a sore leg. She can't go to the doctor. And is she wise? Oh, boy, is she ever. She's wise about nature and survival and all that kind of stuff, right? And she's never been to school, but she's wise.
So then what about, so how do we define knowledge then?
How do we define knowledge? Well, I don't know. You ask. I mean,
how would you? I mean, because the thing, the only reason I'm asking is so.
What's knowledge?
It's a familiarity, awareness, or understanding of someone or something, such as facts, information, descriptions, or skills, which is acquired through experience or education by perceiving, discovering, or learning.
If that definition is right, it's that by knowledge is wisdom.
Equivalence to wisdom.
Yeah.
So does that bring us into, but then the problem that I'm having is if we're to make decisions in business, and if you were to have somebody who is wiser than somebody else because they're older, then is that the way we take the decision? We go with the wiser person?
No. So there's a great book out. This is the best book on mentoring I've ever. It's called Wisdom at Work.
Is this your number one recommended book?
Huh?
Is this the number one book you'd recommend?
It's one number one that I've read in the last 5 years.
Okay. Wisdom at Work, you said?
It's called Wisdom at Work, and the at is an ampersand.
Mm-hmm.
And it's written by a guy by the name of Chip Conley. And Chip Conley gets this phone call. And so he's in San Francisco, and he was 50, early 50s. And he had built a successful chain of boutique hotels, 26 boutique hotels, and then he got in some financial trouble in 2008, and got out of the business. And
mm-hmm.
So a couple of years later, he gets this phone call. I think it was 2012, sometime around there, and the guy says, "Mr. Conley, this is so and so, and I'm wondering, would you mentor me?" And Mr. Conley says, "Well, I don't even know you." And he says, "Well, my name is so-and-so, and I have a business that I just started, and it's kind of in the same niche as yours. So would you mentor me?" And he said, "Well, we'll have to sit down. Let's sit down, and I'll meet with you." Sat down, met with him. They got along. The center, you can feel it pretty. It doesn't take long, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And went on, and that guy was the founder of Airbnb.
Yeah.
And so Chip Conley, he'd been in the hotel business, right? So there's the similarity there. And so he wrote, mentored, I saw a statistic, I subscribed to his blog. I don't know, it went, over 100 people at Airbnb over the 5 years that he was there.
Mm-hmm.
So why am I telling you this? What was it?
Well, Chip, you're probably telling us because Chip would be wiser than the younger person.
Yeah, but he doesn't know as much. Mm-hmm. He's not a tech guy.
Yeah.
So this is a tech company. Airbnb is a tech company, or mm-hmm. I guess it is. I don't know.
Maybe. It is, yeah, sure.
Yeah. Well, I mean, sometimes tech companies that appear to be tech companies really are hospitality companies, right? Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I think Airbnb would say, we're a hospitality company. We're not a tech company.
Right. They just have an app.
Yeah. In any event, Conley knew nothing about technology. Well, he didn't know nothing, but he knew little about technology, but he knew everything about people interacting. And, yeah.
Yeah. And so, okay. So there's times when the founder of Airbnb is listening to Chip's wisdom, but that doesn't make it always right. Like some of the things are going with you're taking, but some you're like, well, this is actually, I guess that just comes down to your own experiences, your own perceptions of your own gut.
Well, I'm not sure what you're asking, but I think that I mean,
so at what point do you listen? At what point do you take your own decision based on our definitions of wisdom and knowledge? And like, well, this person is wiser. This person's been around longer. Oh, you should do exactly what they're saying.
Yeah, well, it doesn't take, you know, it doesn't take long to figure out whether you're getting good advice or bad advice, right? I mean, you follow it a couple of times and it doesn't work, you're getting bad advice, right? Mm-hmm. So, I guess, and you know, wisdom isn't so much about providing answers as rather asking questions.
Mm-hmm.
And Conley is obviously good at asking questions, so he's 26, the founder's 26, he's 51, and Conley, usually, most of the time, the mentee, in this case the Airbnb guy, has the answer somewhere wrapped around there. He just has to be asked the right questions to pull it out.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see myself as a mentor. I don't see myself as being a teacher or a consultant or anything. I consider myself as being someone that's able to one way or another help this person solve his or her problem.
Yeah, you know, that's what Socratic philosophy Socrates is all about, is asking questions. And oftentimes he would just basically, or all the time, it would just be a system of dialogue, of asking questions so that you can find the knowledge that person already had buried within their soul. And just is like, what is the right questions that you can ask to get to that point? I think that's something that our society might be losing to an effect. I see a bunch of people making statements all the time, and I see a lot of people basically, instead of talking in dialogue like we are, they're giving big long speeches, and they don't care what the other person is saying. It's like the willingness to learn has become less and less. I don't know why that is, but what I would like to know is, or what I think would be interesting for myself to learn from you being around is like, what, and for other people too, is like, how does one put themselves in a mind frame of asking more questions?
Well, so this is my mother's favorite saying.
Mm-hmm.
It was, interested is interesting. So if you meet someone and that someone immediately starts talking about himself or herself, you're going to be tuned out really quick. But if you meet someone and they start asking questions, all of a sudden you're interested in that person, right? And so I think that understanding how that works, I don't think that it's going to change the behavior of the guy who wants to talk about himself.
Yeah, I don't either.
Yeah, but I think...
What's the good that person could end up getting from this, though? Why does that person want to talk about himself?
Ego.
why do they want their ego inflated?
Well, if it's a guy, it's testosterone, right? I don't know what. I don't.
Well, it's, well, they want, why do you, why, is it that feeling of self-importance? I'm not that, I mean, I'm going deep just for fun right now, but I mean, that feeling of self-importance, that feeling of value.
You've got people in your life that does that, right? That you've got the, somebody like that is in your life, so I don't
know. I used to be like that all the time. It still comes up.
Okay, well then, why are you asking me? You're the expert.
Am I?
Yeah, well, you have wisdom on the topic because you have experience.
All right, Jim. Okay, if we talk from my own experience, my own wisdom on the matter, I would feel that I would only have value at a new social gathering of people and friends, potential friends, business networking, whatever the thing was, if they knew how important I was. And if they knew how important I was, then they would value me more. So I had to be able to tell them the accomplishments I've done and make sure I list them all off and don't forget about any. And if they weren't that impressed by me, well, then you must have forgotten to say that one thing you did here or that one thing there. So, but what do we find is actually, like, what did you just say about that, though? Like, that's not interesting.
No. Mm-mm. And my response to that would be, if that person has to know how important you are, then I don't want to know that person. Now, maybe, you know, maybe if you're on an elevator, the old elevator pitch, right?
Sure.
The elevator pitch thing. Maybe if you're trying to sell him something, I guess, and you've got three floors to do it, that's another situation. But typically, I mean, if I go to a social event or something, and that happens, that's not.
Did I ever do that to you?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
Not to my knowledge.
We've crossed paths about, I don't know, probably a dozen times or so in our lives. But yeah, maybe you never got the pleasure of hearing me go off about how awesome I was.
Yeah.
I'm glad. Well, I'm glad you never got.
You
to
know
hear
what?
That.
You, Preston speaks highly of you, well, and Preston's one of my favorite people, and so. You pass.
Well, that's great to hear. Preston's one of my favorite people too. Okay, so the book we had down is the one that you're talking about the most, which you had up. Wise is
Wisdom at Work.
Chris Collins.
Chip Conley.
Chip Conley. Thanks. I actually heard a podcast with him and Tim Ferriss. It was fascinating. Going through that whole thing. I guess what I'd like to end on a little bit is just getting into the, let's just end with a little bit of fun of what everybody likes to talk in negatively or positively about, which is Ben's growth over the past, let's see, 10 years. So it's a thing. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? Let's start with that from you.
Depends on who you talk to.
I'm talking to you.
Okay. For me, I told you earlier, I'm a growth guy. So I like growth. And I mean, I think it's, you know, economically, it's obviously good for the community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the 80-20 rule is in effect, right? 80% of the problems are brought out by 20% of the people.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had incidences where the location of the OSU campus is a perfect example, right? 80-20 rules. 80% of the noise came from 20% of the people.
Yep. It was a lot of noise, too.
Mm-hmm. The Southern Crossing, the bridge down there.
That's an excellent example we talked about yesterday. I would love you to go into depth of that really quick. So what happened? So the Southern Crossing Bridge, for those of you that are from Central Oregon, basically it's a Reed Market Bridge. And many of you probably know about it that live in town, and it's your main way of getting to Bachelor. If you live in certain areas of town, it's your main way of getting to this side of town, this side being the west side. But it used to not exist.
Yeah.
So when was it? When was it built?
Oh, I don't know. It was back in the early 2000s sometime.
Okay.
That the project came up. We need that Southern Crossing Bridge, and there was a very vocal minority in the community that were dead set against it, and so the situation unfolded not unlike the OSU issue, and when it was all the smoke cleared, their complaints were, I assume, duly recognized, but the bridge went up anyway. And obviously today Bend could not, I don't know what Bend would look like without that Southern Crossing Bridge.
There would be a line near our office that would continue all the way to past the highway, past the freeway, and keep on going to try to go both ways on that. It would be, it wouldn't just be during bachelor time.
Yeah.
It would be all the time.
But the point is that there's, I mean, you get 100,000 people and the 80-20 rule is going to be alive and well. There's always going to be 20% or whatever that percentage is that don't agree with whatever the project is.
Yeah. How do you think, what's the best way like a town should, or even a company for analogies that exist there, should deal with that 20%? Because you can't make everyone happy. You're very right.
No, you make your decision and you move on. I mean, it's, you know, they would tell you that it's all about transparency, right?
Yeah.
And but at some point in time, you just have to move on and let the noise subside.
Do you think that often comes that 20% is from people's fear of change?
Some of it, certainly. Yeah. Some of it. I just ran into somebody last night at dinner who they're going to leave Bend.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and they're going to leave Bend. What was they live out on the other side of Reed Market, and they're pissed off still about that.
The bridge?
No, it's that. You drive the Reed Market east.
I know about, if you're talking about the traffic.
Yeah, yeah. That's the worst engineered. The ODOT spent, I don't know, $20 million
or
whatever.
Yeah, it took years.
And it's still a single lane winding, stoplight driven railroad crossing.
Yeah.
Stupidest. But in any event, so these people are going to leave town because of that. Okay. They live out the other side of Reed Market.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, c'est la vie.
I suppose so. C'est la vie. The, you know, the interesting thing on the people that had such a problem with the Reed Market Bridge is I wonder how often they use it.
The Reed Market, you mean the Southern Crossing Bridge?
Yeah, yeah.
My guess would be they probably use it.
Yeah.
Frequently.
Yeah, probably almost. Some people could be every day.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the change, things end up happening. You resist the change, but... why? Like, that's the part of life that is one thing that is constant. It's just we live in a changing society. We live in flux. Like the argument that you can not step in the same river twice. You know, well, I think it was Socrates that said that you can't even step in the same river once. Because once you put your foot in there, like you're already creating. As soon as it touches, the argument can be made that there is changes instantly at that moment. That things are happening. But people, like, when they have a hard time of watching Bend grow, they're holding on to something that can't be preserved, because nothing can.
Yeah.
But how much better is it now than some of the negative times you've seen?
Negative times?
08, if you want to call that negative.
Oh, well, that had, of course, that had very little to do with Bend.
No.
And the next one will probably be the same thing.
Right, but there's those that say, like, since we were hit a bit harder, it was because of, like, our dependencies in 08 were on just, what, tourism and real estate?
Yeah, and what goes up fast goes down fast.
Yeah.
And so we were always at the top of the growth curve, right? And
so you think that'll just happen again since we're going up fast again? Well, that's
hopefully great. Not to the hopefully not to the degree that 2008 was.
Yeah, Well, do you think because we have different industries? That's one of the arguments I've heard, because if we have so many different industries right now that are supporting the town.
Yeah, we're broader than we used to be.
And it shouldn't go down as hard.
Yeah, but it'll still go down hard.
Okay. Well, it's coming from wisdom.
I mean, you know, you look at, I don't know how many tech companies we have in town, 150 maybe. Roger Lee would probably tell you sometime we're between 100 and 150. And their customers are all somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
They're not in Bend.
No.
So it's what happens out there that drives their success. Here in Bend, the developers and the car companies and all the traditional businesses, what happens in Bend determines their success. But with the tech guys and same with bioscience, same mm-hmm. with outdoor, even to a degree, microbrewery, right? I mean, a lot of our microbrewers export their products now. So we're tied to the national economy, whether we like it or not.
Yeah, that's what's happening here too. Well, Jim, I appreciate you coming on and sharing all your wisdom, my friend. This has been
it's fun.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Okay.
And I appreciate it. Thank you. We'll be right back.